Hiya, Wanju, hello, welcome to another episode of The Curb. I'm Andrew Pierce, and this is a podcast where I bring you in-depth interviews with filmmakers, creatives, and curators of culture. This podcast is recorded in Boorloo, Western Australia, sovereignty never ceded. The Koalas is a documentary that follows in the footsteps of the McIntyres documentary Kangaroo, A Love-Hate Story, and Jane Hammond's Black Cockatoo Crisis, in that it essays the plight of an Australian icon, the koala, alongside the stories of activists, ecologists, politicians, and wildlife carers who are putting themselves on the line to save the iconic creature. Directed and produced by Gregory Miller and Georgia Wallace Crabb, The Koalas is a powerful, if at times devastating, documentary that speaks to a crisis occurring right in front of us. Whether it's bushfires or landscape clearing or road strikes, the life of the koala is always in danger. Georgia speaks to me ahead of the Koala's screening at the Berlin Down Under Film Festival on the 29th of September, on Adelaide on the 29th of September as well, in Darwin at the Deck Chair Cinema on the 30th of September, and in Copenhagen on October 3rd and 6th. In the following extensive conversation, Georgia talks about her journey into filmmaking, her path from winning awards at Melbourne Film Festival to making films that told global stories, and also the importance of creating a film about the koala and why she chose to do that now. This is a generous discussion with Georgia and one that I'm grateful to have had. If you are interested in the work that is occurring across the nation to support koalas, please seek out this film. For additional information and future film screenings, visit thekoalasfilm.com. I will stick a link in the show notes. I want to also thank you as well for listening to this episode of The Curb podcast. If you have been a listener of The Curb, interviews and all this kind of stuff, then I really appreciate it. As a small plug as well, I'm currently doing a Kickstarter campaign for my latest book, which is called Lonely Spirits and the King. It is available on Kickstarter right now. If you head over to thecurb.com.au, I will link to that as well. We have about 15 days for that to run, and it is almost funded. So please, if you like the idea of supporting independent books, but also books about Australian films, this is a 700-page book that is all about Australian cinema and features interviews just like the one that you're about to hear with Georgia. Please head over to Kickstarter and support the book. As little as a dollar really helps us get over the line. You can just support the campaign if you can. Alternatively, we have everything all the way up to books with Blu-ray copies as well. So there's a whole variety of different things. Nonetheless, that's enough self-promotion from me. You can also head over to patreon.com/thecurbau to show your support as well and to keep The Curb completely independent. Thanks again for listening. Let's have a listen to the trailer for the film. I also highly recommend checking out the trailer and watching the visuals of it as well, because it's quite a visually striking film too. I will stick a link to that in the show notes as well. Far too much rambling from me here. Here is the trailer for The Koalas. Again, all those screening links and dates are in the show notes too. Thanks again for listening.
I'll get Joey.
It'd be great if people could not post this on Facebook too, by the way.
He made the front cover of Time magazine online. Pretty good front cover.
Without urgent government action, koalas will become extinct before 2050.
It's not that we don't have the answers, it's that nobody will control the developer.
We can't release her in an area where they've actually physically got the bulldozers and pulling all the trees down and getting ready for the developments.
What we've been doing so far hasn't worked. All the money in the world is not going to save koalas. We need to actually stop cutting down the trees they call home.
It does, in the end, come down to a cronyism, which is about, you know, the people who are the mates and who have dinner with the minister on a regular basis or have access.
This whole forest is gated with cameras, and so Gumbanga elders locked out of our forest, out of our homeland.
I want to go back to when you started as a filmmaker. What was the impetus or the kernel that set you off on the journey that you wanted to become a filmmaker and telling stories on film?
I was a child film buff. I went to Cinematheque at Melbourne University as a child because my father taught there. So I was watching, you know, Cocteau and Les Enfants du Paradis and all those films, the New Wave and Bergman, when I was very, very small. And I think I just one day discovered film school in the book, the VTAB book or whatever they call the book when you're looking for your course. And I'd been torn between literature and languages, archaeology, you know, music. I'd been very kind of multi-skilled, but, you know, in the arts. And I already had people in my family who were in music, who were in literature, who were in painting. So I wasn't going to, in design, I wasn't going to go down the same road and compete directly. I just wanted my own field. And then one day I thought, film really combines it all. And what do you do when you don't want to think about something like this? You watch a midnight movie and stay up all night. You know? So, I applied to Swinburne Film School, got in, deferred the course. They told me I was the first, Swinburne's now VCA, but they told me I was the first student to have the gall to ask for a deferment, but I'd said it in the book that you could do that. So I went travelling, came back, did film school, and graduated at 23 or something, and my short film won Best Short Film at Melbourne Film Festival. And they were back in the days of Erwin Rado, and it's actually kind of strangely the year that Melbourne Film Festival went bankrupt, and they forgot to pick up Cary Grant from his hotel to bring him to a retrospective of Rear Window. They left him in his hotel and he went to the zoo with his wife instead. So it was a strange year, but anyway. So my film did the rounds of film festivals overseas. In those days, the AFI distributed Swinburne films and submitted them to festivals, and it went to quite a few festivals, was officially regretted by Oberhausen Film Festival. So I had some sort of early controversy. And then kind of actually got a job programming at the precursor to ACME, which was the State Film Centre of Victoria. So I worked for a year or so in programming, went to Berlin Film Festival as a buyer, sort of ran around the globe, but then realised that you had to sort of go home and become a filmmaker. And you had to go back to your home country, and, you know, you weren't going to become a filmmaker in France or Germany if you're an Australian. So I went back and engaged in, you know, the grants programs that were available at that time through Experimental Film Fund, and collaborated with, you know, my fellow filmmaking graduates from film school and other filmmakers, Melbourne filmmakers, and worked kind of as a producer and more in collaborative roles and in cross-genre films. My graduation film was a mock documentary about Albert Speer, the Nazi architect, walking around the world in his imagination, which is based on his prison diary.
I'm curious then, was that original, the award win and the support from the Melbourne Film Festival at the time, did that kind of set you off on the path of going, yes, I'm onto the right thing? Or did you need that kind of sense of encouragement to continue being a filmmaker? Or was it going to be in the face of encouragement, you're going to be a filmmaker no matter what?
Oh, no, I think it was really significant. But, you know, like my film wasn't shown in the graduation crop at Swinburne. It was shown in the early afternoon, these weird movies we don't know what to do with slot. So when I got called up to Melbourne Film Festival, I was, you know, at the laundromat or something to get up there to, you know, accept my award. So it wasn't expected. And so all these, you know, the success of that film and whatever was going on with that was sort of, you know, it's an intuitive process that I hadn't really a lot of insight into. But I did feel I was on the right track once I won an award. But, you know, Melbourne, I think I went for jobs at Crawford's and they said, do you want to drive a truck or do you type? And I just, you know, won Best Short Film at Melbourne Film Festival. So it was pretty brutal initially. And you kind of had to work out how to pay the rent, you know, from day one. And, you know, having moved out of home before I started film school. So the combining of paid jobs and creative projects probably for the next 10 years or more got me, you know, working in film production and in parallel sort of film culture events. So I worked for Melbourne Film Festival off and on as a volunteer and then later as a staff member, and I worked in programming, and, you know, I probably wouldn't have chosen producing either if I didn't realise it was a smart way of, you know, making films where you didn't, where you were always hands-on, you know, you were always had a finger in every pie in the process.
So let's then jump forward a little bit to talking about working with Gregory, who you've obviously had a long career working alongside. What was that initial kind of foundation of deciding that the path that you both were going to go on as creative filmmakers?
Well, when we met, he actually invited me to the Adelaide Documentary Festival, or AIDC, before I knew what it was, and I thought it didn't sound like a party and it sounded like hard work, but he was quite serious about film and documentary and working in exhibition and had a job, that these were all attractive elements. I mean, I did really believe there was a sustainable path, and I had some significant grants from the Australian Film Commission at that point. So I think looking at friends and collaborators as being one and the same thing. All my friends were filmmakers or dreaming of being filmmakers, or film school graduates, or friends who'd done art department or writing on our film. So there was a very, you know, vibrant kind of, I guess it's like a graduate culture of all the people doing those things, and we didn't, you know, cost a lot to live. So we just continued trying to make our own films and think of films that we might be able to sell. I think his experience with AIDC had us thinking about selling films to markets, you know, quite early. And we collaborated on a film about Japanese Butoh theatre. I got a grant to go to Paris through the Australia Council for the Australia Council studio. And it seemed logical, of course, not at the time, to go to Japan on the way and research Butoh theatre, which was a sort of subcultural phenomenon in Japan. And we did get a pre-sale to SBS, and we did shoot a lot, but we were shooting film at that point. You know, we spent almost half a year in Europe. It was Japan culture year in Europe. It seemed like a great idea because we could film Butoh in Europe. But really hard to sell. And when we got back to Australia, there was a recession, and the funders and people were saying, we don't want to support Japan. They're our cultural kind of, you know, dominating economic force of our major trading partner. They don't need encouragement, sort of thing. So we didn't get it up, and something happened to our pre-sale where another film about Japanese theatre was sold to SBS, and they backed out of our pre-sale. But anyway, that kind of got us on the path. We met filmmakers in Europe. We met people to collaborate with. We went to Cinematheque, you know, and we just kept doing what we like to do, really, from there on in, and trying to, it was probably a few years. We moved to Sydney a couple of years after returning to Australia, because all the funding seemed to be concentrated in Sydney, and we were going up and down the highway a lot, pitching films. He was working at the Chevelle Cinema, programming and running that. Yeah, we started pitching films into the international documentary kind of circuit and trying to sell them into television. So we probably had a pretty good run for about 20 years where we got major sales of programs to partners overseas, and then we're able to leverage the existing funding mechanisms here. So we did some pretty wacky deals. From about 2000, we sold films, we did co-productions with Canada, we sold films to Finland, we did films in India, we've done films in China. We did, you know, Sharks, Ned Kelly and Breaker Morant. We sold them to commercial television. So it wasn't all, although I'd had a track record with SBS, and we together sold about 10 programs to SBS over the years. ABC has always been hard to crack, even though I've worked for the ABC, quite hard to pre-sell for them. And somehow our programs were always, they were always passion projects, things that we were wanting to make and curious about, or found the market was also interested in something that we were interested in. So, but we did diversify, and it included science and natural history and history, as well as social and documentary and arts documentary, which is probably how it started, this sort of stories.
Was there a particular project that you worked on at that time where the response was kind of maybe unexpected, or you didn't realise the kind of level of impact that the work that you were doing might have?
It's a bit hard to say. I mean, I kind of think of some of the projects as horses for courses. I also had a kid during that period. So I had, there was about a 10-year period where Gregory would have been the lead on the projects, and we had other co-producers and he had other partners or co-directors. And there's a few, there's That's Your Breaker Morant and Your Ned Kelly and so on. And I am really interested in Australian history, but I probably would have myself chosen more kind of feminist revisiting or post-colonial revisitings of those histories. So on occasion I would line produce, co-produce with other producers. So there was a film called Temple on the Hill, which was by a young Indian director called Kay Rasool, and we'd been doing films in India, and I'd been to India with one of my drama films, the drama short film that I'd made in Victoria with Screen Victoria, Film Victoria. And that film was kind of one of those ones where all the ducks just lined up and everything just flowed. So it was about Sikh Indian community of Woolgoolga. We got a really amazing ob doctor, DOP, Phil Bull. We had Suresh Ayar, who was an Indian Australian editor of feature films. He wanted to do it. There was a guy who was a half Indian Australian sound recordist, also top of his game. We got 5-star accommodation at a resort that turned out to belong to a Sikh Singapore millionaire. We stayed in Woolgoolga in a resort. We got money from New South Wales, Screen New South Wales. And we got support from, I don't know, journalism department at UTS. And then we sold it to SBS. And in lots of ways, that was like one of those sort of dream projects, except the director was a pain in the ass and she fought with everyone. And like, I don't know, it was just interesting to see how it flows when it flows. But you don't always have a good time on the projects that flow. And sometimes the projects that are a struggle are better films. At the end of the day. So there was another one, Jade Babe, with Janet Merriweather, which won the AFI Award and the IFF Award for Best Documentary. And that was an amazingly complex kind of, complex in its conception, hybrid documentary about a tall girl with Marfan syndrome. I don't know if you've ever heard of that film. It was really complicated and involved sets and props and performative reenactments of kind of fantasy sequence, and then different layers of flashback using, I think we shot film. And then the flashbacks were shot on black and white video and then refilmed on film and small monitors in sets. And it was an amazing production. And Janet's vision and a whole lot of really amazing creatives made it really an amazing experience, but also a big struggle. And it was a really successful film, but a real struggle process. So that's the direct inverse of the other one. And at the end of late 2000s, I decided I needed to return to directing. So I decided I could make a film in China about the redevelopment of Beijing. And I think I worked out that no one was going to give me a gig as a director, and I'd been producing for too long. And certainly moving to Sydney had pigeonholed me as a producer, and I was producing with my partner. So I decided to make a film about something that I knew about, that I felt that I had a an insight into, which was architecture and redevelopment in China and cultural heritage. And basically we pitched that into some markets, didn't get it funded, but we got some funds from Screen Australia and shot it pretty much on development funds. But I worked with Chinese shooters and went up to China on my own. That was a really rewarding experience because that brought me back to filmmaking, that I could just go with a camera person and shoot interviews and construct, you know, to find the film in the making, and that it could still be aesthetic and, you know, have a visual richness even if it was being sort of shot off the hip as the story was being found. And I got support through, I'm trying to remember the name of the fund, I think Bob Connolly was on the panel at Screen Australia, and it was one of those creative funds where you actually got funded for your directorial vision. And I don't know if they still have those funds, but, you know, as a mid-career filmmaker, I had a vision for a project, and so I made it without a broadcaster, and it has made it to a lot of festivals around the world and won some awards. And I had really great times going to Chinese Film Festival with a Chinese film and being, even when the film was banned at Guangzhou Documentary Festival, I was with the Salon de Refusés, which were the group of filmmakers who were all famous for their Chinese documentaries, like Yung Chan, who made Up the Yangtze, and what's his name, who did Last Train Home, I'll think of his name later, I Steal Films. Anyway, it was just really great times to go to Beijing and show it in underground film festivals, go to Taipei, it showed in a lot of places. I went to Russia, to an island somewhere above Japan called Sakhalin in the far east of Russia, to a thing called the Edge of the World Film Festival. Anyway, so I love going to obscure film festivals. So I really miss making festival films, like some of our early films, you know, got us to India and Egypt and places like that with our films. So, they were the memorable ones at the moment that stand out for me.
But it seems like you need to have some kind of connection to the narrative to be able to bring it to screen for it to be a significant project, which I guess is a natural way of leading into The Koalas, which is so distinctly an Australian story because it is about an icon in Australia and the impact that is currently, you know, both governments, domestic, the federal and state governments, and then also local governments, creating decisions which are really causing devastating impact onto the koala habitat and their lives. I'm curious for you what the personal connection is for the koalas. Why were you eager to explore and tell this particular story right now?
Well, it actually connects to the new Beijing film because I guess we're both environmentally concerned people. We're not idiots. So the new Beijing film, I just was really kind of horrified and intrigued about the speed of change. And a lot of the architects I was talking to were talking about sustainability and environmental issues in China. And we became really aware of China's impact on the world and the rise of China and climate change. And it led to me doing a doctorate at Wollongong where I thought I was going to do a series about climate change and the greening of China and how people were misapprehending what was happening or what had to happen, because China actually was transitioning. A lot of its new uptake of energy was renewable. There was kind of top-down legislation that could cut emissions with a wave of a pen, you know, that they didn't have to follow us down the consumption road. And that possibly with partnership with the West, China could make a different story possible. And that really came out of me seeing China at a very open moment and talking to people who are partnering with China in architecture, you know, amazing architectural projects, which we featured in that earlier New Beijing film. So I just felt it was such a global you know, melting pot of people with imagination that, you know, everything was possible. And I didn't get the Greening China series going, but I did a doctorate about coal and iron ore and our relationship to China in relation to those exports and the culpability of Australia with coal exports in global emissions and, you know, our lifestyle being the benefit that we take from those exports. So I felt like there were just deep questions about the environment and that we needed to be thinking about them. And Greg had also done a number of projects which we'd produced, including Tipping Points, about the climate tipping points. That was earlier. That was, you know, 10 or 15 years ago before. And, you know, broadcasters were saying, oh, we did a film about climate change. We don't need another one. So we did a whole series of things for like the Weather Channel and various global channels about the climate. And so it's sort of one of those things you can't ignore once you've been looking at it for a while. So the Australian environment, the degradation of the Australian environment became a concern. We made a film which Greg directed and I produced with him called Cultivating Murder, about the murder of an environment officer by a farmer in 2014. Glenn Turner was murdered because a farmer was aggravated by being prosecuted for illegal land clearing. And as a result of that, he was found guilty, but the land clearing laws were actually ultimately wound back in New South Wales, and land clearing's escalated at an alarming rate since then. So koalas came into that film. People were out in Western New South Wales where the murder happened in what is now broadacre farming land, just sort of targeting koalas just for no, and wildlife for no good reason, just cutting down trees on you know, what remained of the bush, which was strips of land along highways and, you know, creek beds. And they were just so hell-bent on removing every tree from the landscape, like it was just a war. It was an ideological war against nature or the natural landscape. And that was a pretty overwhelming experience. We screened the film all around New South Wales. We took it to communities. We talked to people like the Greens and other sort of advocate groups and Environmental Defenders Office. People told us stuff about what was going on in New South Wales government, you know, off the record, that basically the Liberal National Party, well, the National Party had the Liberals by the short and curly and controlled all rural land policy. So the more we learnt, the more we realised that the system was really broken and that animals and nature didn't really stand a chance if people allowed a broken system and abdicated responsibility to the powers that be, like the CSIRO's been defunded, you know, environmental laws have been defunded, the, what's it called, the Anti-Corruption Commission had no teeth, you know, the Land and Environment Court always fell in favour of the developer. There was just all these failures of mechanisms that were leading to ultimately what we saw happening to koalas in the West. And as we saw the fires, I guess the trigger for the film was the fires, catastrophic fires that the whole world saw, that you could see, you know, the smoke in space, and the world all poured out their generosity to support Australia. And I think they believed Australia would do the right thing by their wildlife. And just to see that they were continuing to log those forests, basically lie about the protections that were really being offered to threatened species. Koalas became enlisted as endangered, and it was all just business as usual for both Liberal and Labor with regard to logging, with regard to land clearing for development and so on.
I remember seeing after the bushfires that weeks, maybe not even weeks, but in Victoria, they were already sending in people to clear the forest as soon as the bushfires stopped. And it was just, there was no time for any healing to occur. And this is, Yeah, it's unbelievable. And I guess from a Western Australia perspective, it's hard for us to fathom sometimes, and maybe for the rest of the world to fathom, that, you know, the koalas are a national icon and they're endemic to certain areas, and yet we clear away their habitat. We effectively reducing the space that they're available to live. And what I love about the film is that you shine a light on the people who are putting their bodies on the line, quite literally standing on the side of the road to try and protect koalas and to bring awareness of their existence and the damage and the impact that they're having at the moment for vehicles or logging and things like that. So you're bringing that human element into it. But it is such a powerful thing to be able to see people who I assume have jobs and have lives and stuff, but are doing this in every spare moment. And I'm curious if you can talk about what it was like to bring that human element into it, these people who are challenging those powers at play to be able to say, no, we will not allow a national icon to be treated this way.
Yeah, well, initially, because we were following the thread of the storylines, like we started with the anti-development campaign in Campbelltown, southwest Sydney. The story was a human story about the battle between the developer having been given carte blanche basically on this beautiful piece of farmland, and these very, you know, vulnerable small group of protesters who could see the consequence. Like, a lot of these issues are complex and you need to be quite deep into the ecology to understand that one or two paddock trees in a particular location happens to be a corridor between two colonies of koalas that will no longer be viable if those few trees are taken out. Like, most people just see what's a few trees, but a few trees here and a few trees there, and gradually the island populations are reduced and they become genetically compromised or go locally extinct and so on. So we needed the humans to tell the story, and then we realised we needed koalas because it was a film about koalas. So it actually worked the other way around. It was a film with too many humans probably talking as we gathered the story, and then we realised we just needed human-animal interaction, and that the empathy thread lies in the human-animal interaction. And that the other ideas are challenging and people do shut down around complex environmental stories, especially that involve science plus legal mechanisms plus, you know, observations of things that people are not expert in. So we had to get onto koalas. We got close to the wildlife rescue people, both as individuals, and then we got funding by WIRES to tell the story of the rescuers. And strangely, the funding bodies were a bit arrogant or a bit dismissive about that strategy. They said, oh, it's about wildlife rescue, as if that wasn't going to get us to the nub of the story. Because they want human stories that are, you know, we were told by the Screen Australia, oh, you know, normally you focus on one character. It's like, well, our character is the koala. And we're going to get to the bottom of the koala story. And everywhere we went, it was a slightly different koala story. We had to tell that story. And then we had to thread it on a loom where the overarching story is the koala story. And it always came back to habitat. But here it seemed to be car strike, and there it was disease, and here it was the fires and what they'd done. But everywhere it was koalas and their landscape, and the driver was human impact, you know, via be it climate change, be it land clearing development, or whatever the driver of the land clearing was. So the people were inspiring. We actually dedicate the film to a woman called Sharon Cullis, who sadly died in the first year really of us making the film. And she was an ecologist and a science educator and an activist, and she would go out walking in the national park spotting koalas in the morning. She'd swim in the ocean in the morning, then she'd walk in the park and spot koalas, and she'd go and fight the undermining of our water table by the coal mining through the middle of the day, and then she'd be on Zoom at night talking about the koalas in Campbelltown. She was just so switched on and so intelligent and, you know, reasonable in her conversations with people. And a lot of the carers, a lot of the scientists, you know, there are a lot of women, I've got to say that. It's, I don't know if you noticed, but, you know, the animal carers, the rescuers, you know, quite a lot of the vets, you know, they're these compassionate thinking people. They're not flashy. They're not, you know, getting a lot of attention for what they're doing. But they're deeply compassionate for the animals and for the interconnected webs of nature, you know, in which the animals live. So we were learning, we were interacting with people who could educate us. So I guess the characters in the film were people, the ones who made the cut were people who really could take the viewer as well as us on a journey to understanding more about the koala and what was going on for koalas.
I mean, I do love that dichotomy between the carers and the support and the koala. And as you're saying, that connective thread of the landscape is so vitally important. But I'm curious for you, as you're compiling the footage, some of it is very difficult to watch. I mean, the impact of, as you're saying, car strikes, the impact of bushfires, etc., on koalas is difficult to sit with. How do you process that as somebody who's working through and compiling the footage and deciding what to present and what not to present that is might be complicated for audiences to sit with?
It was a long edit, and I have to say Gregory was the principal editor, and I guess I sat back and gave feedback, and we had some test screenings and so on. But the first edit was much harder. It was so hard, people just cried. And a lot of the sequences that got back into the film were the soft story, feel-good sequences that you just needed to have hope and to feel empathy. And they included baby koalas, cute koalas, koala mother and baby, you know, bonding scenes, you know, beautifully shot stuff, people planting trees, you know, communities doing good stuff. At the end of the day, we needed that narratively, but, you know, we didn't have a script. We found the film in the edit. But the first thing we had to do was build the thesis, and that was more around ideas, and it was probably too talky. And then the more we were able to cut down the principal interviews into the pithiest version we had so that they kind of represented what you might have scripted had you scripted it. The more we were able to thread back geographic visuals, things that were locators, and cutaways that were also story-based and observational in their filming. So there was a lot of observational sequences, and there was a lot of information, and just the threading was just a very long process. And like I said, test screening, at least there was one key test screening where people cried, and people also wrote index cards and dropped them into our letterbox, and, you know, it took it really seriously about wanting to know. They wanted to know the understanding and outcome of each point in the film, each subplot. They really wanted to know, what do we understand by that, and where did that one go, and what happened after that. So we resisted having a narration, but we did have to go back in and put some text on the screen and say, what happened at the result of this court case? What happens, you know, 6 months later, the bridges haven't been built, you know, the Forestry Commission's still smashing the forest or escalating the speed of cutting, and actually kind of create a bit more editorial sharpness. You know, we could have gone a lot sharper, I guess, if we had a narrator, but then it would have seemed like a more subjective film and a more opinionated film, and it might have lost audiences. At the moment, we're getting very bipartisan responses from people from different political persuasions, because they don't see it as having a clear political bias or agenda, which I think it could have had if we'd gone with a scripted narration or something.
Doing what I do, I get to watch a lot of different films, and I see a lot of different nature documentaries and environmental documentaries. And one of those things has been that, you know, the narrative perspective, which does present this kind of stance of, here is my opinion, I hope you walk away with it at the end. Was that a really difficult thing to kind of decide, we're going to step away from that kind of perspective during the edit and during the cut?
I don't think we've really ever made films in that style. We just, you know, don't like them. You know, we want our characters to have their own voice. We've tried to do films that were observational as much as possible. Like when we've worked with broadcasters and television and have had narrations and narrators, they often still have had, you know, kudos as being historians or authorities who were speaking from their position in the film. So you could still locate yourself with regard to that. I just don't think we're in the age where we want to hear polemical filmmakers telling us what to think. People are too clever for that. They're too sophisticated. And it is harder to do a film that way. You know, I think if we had had a broadcaster, we would have been encouraged or forced to do it differently. And I just think the film benefits by the observational process and the peeling back and the washing over the audience, but we wouldn't have had the privilege of the long edit and so on. And, you know, as it is, we screen it in places and people go, well, you've done Queensland, you've done Victoria, but you haven't done South Australia. It's like everyone, you know, you did two koala hospitals. Why didn't you do ours? Like, this is not exhaustive. We can't have every koala hospital in the country in our film. But, you know, we tried. We tried to really cover the broadest scale. But it was to understand that the animal is right across that landscape and suffering similar things wherever those impacts are happening. And it also is very divide and conquer kind of landscape where all the different environment groups are isolated from one another and sort of competing for funding and, you know, exhausted and, you know, just not seeing that the people in Victoria are suffering from different laws that are also impacting their wildlife, but it's coming from a different driver, perhaps. Anyway, I get exhausted just talking about it. I need a lie down.
Well, that's what I was going to say. I mean, it's you've been spending a lot of time in this headspace and thinking about, obviously, the film, but also the production and these tangential stories, which we might not get to see on screen. But now it's out in the world. You've had screenings locally and you're heading overseas and having screenings overseas. What does it mean to be able to present a film like The Koalas to an international audience?
Well, the whole time we were making it, we were hoping to get it to international audiences. It's really key for us that it's seen internationally. Like, I think Yahoo Media, Michael Dahlstrom, who's a great supporter of environmental stories, he captioned one interview that he did with us about the film, saying the filmmakers were embarrassed by Australia and Australia's attitudes to our threatened species. But that is kind of the tone of the film, that we want people to understand that what's going on is, you know, to Australia's shame. And people don't expect a first world country or a developed country to be allowing its forests, you know, paying to have its forests exported and accelerating its coal exports at a time when the rest of the world really are trying to curb those extractionist sort of industries and trying to preserve species. You know, we've got so many unique species. Why we can't treat them with the reverence they deserve and support them is just gobsmacking. And, you know, we should have, I think we've had a very dry economic kind of view shoved down our throat by a very narrow media for a very long time. And people think they're struggling when they're still, you know, some of the per capita most affluent people in the world living here. You know, the sort of entitlement and the sense that everyone deserves a view of the ocean and two cars and a boat and a holiday overseas. I just don't think people are willing to compromise for the environment at all on the whole, or even seeing this. We're now so urbanised, we're not seeing what's happening in our landscape. You know, at least people in rural areas are seeing this. They're witnessing the demise of the animals on the road, the die-off of the trees that aren't coming back, the different, I think in Perth you've got a black cockatoo crisis and a ringtail possum crisis, and you've got a few other crises going on the urban fringe of Perth. It's not so different. Everywhere in Australia, these massive cities are just eating up landscape and we're not noticing what we're losing, which is a cultural loss as well too. This, Australians not understanding their landscape and their bush as well.
And that comes back to the core of what A Story About Koalas is. It is about Australia. There is, they are more than just being the cute, fluffy animal who people get to hug at Taronga Zoo. it's that they are symbolic of who we like to think we might be as people, and yet we don't treat it nicely. And, as we've discussed, destroy their heritage. How I tend to, especially talking to Australian filmmakers, and we're talking about something that is so distinctly Australian, I tend to ask about what it means to present Australian films on stories on screen, and what it means to you to present Australian culture on screen. And coming back to that core notion of koalas being so distinctly Australian, I'm curious, there seems to be an extra level or layer on this particular story. It is so vitally important. It is this cry for help. So I'm curious for you what that means to be able to present a story like this on screen, to really examine Australiana in this particular way.
Okay, there are kind of two ways of answering that. And, if Greg was here, he would answer it differently. So I might actually give... I want to just give a shot at that first, because it's a kind of cinema question. And having worked in exhibition and distribution, both of us, and loving cinemas, we've actually released this film with Dov from Screen Inc. We've been putting it in cinemas, and it's been in cinemas since June. And, there has been this popularity of this so-called impact model of documentary features going into cinemas, and a lot of times documentaries don't demand to be a feature, and feature length is really tricky for Australian films generally to actually work in a cinema. So having a background in cinema exhibition and wanting to take it to audiences and meet audiences was a really key part of our intention. That the putting a film on television and it being gone the next day was just a really demoralising experience. And, we both loved film festivals and we loved running cinemas. And Greg, I said, had run the Chevelle in Melbourne, or the Chevelle in Sydney at one time, and managed the Valhalla in Melbourne at another time, and I'd worked for Melbourne Film Festival. We just really wanted those experiences to show audiences and to have conversations with audiences. So, at one time we could have jumped to a 60-minute film and continued to try and sell it as a one-off, but broadcasters aren't really buying one-offs that they haven't commissioned. We would have probably taken a commission for a three-part series if someone had gone for one, and there's enough content in the film for that. But we pushed for the 90 minutes, and, it was going to be always 70 to 90 for a cinema. And, like I said, the test screening suggested the 70-minute was too tough, was too harsh, it was too hard and brutal as an experience, and we put back in 20 minutes or something, or 70 to 90 anyway. And it got more air and the storytelling became more logical, and it just became less of a kind of radio with pictures and more of a film. And then, audiences have responded to that, and, no one's complained about the length of the film at 90. So we've done a lot. What it means to tell a film about an Australian issue and show it in Australian cinemas is really important. We had a full house in Audley in the Royal National Park in Sutherland on Saturday night. We had a screening at Armadano in Varel on Sunday night. We had a screening in Avoca on Monday night. They were all activated by panellists of environmentalists, wildlife carers, and local advocates for wildlife, and really powerful experiences for the people who attended. And we aren't always able to attend, but they all had powerful experiences. We get this feedback from, you know, the ecologists on the panel and the wildlife carers that they've been, they're sort of suffering in silence and isolation in those landscapes. And to have 40 people or 50 people or 60, 80, 100 people, it's they're not kind of mortified if it's 30 or 40 people if they have a really valuable conversation about what they can do in the landscape.
Even just having a conversation with one person, you know, that can mean the world. It doesn't, the audience size doesn't mean a huge amount. I mean, it does obviously mean a huge amount, but it's the conversations that erupt from those particular experiences as well, as you're saying.
And for this is an activist film or an advocacy film. It needs impact. It needs a call to action at the end, and having an articulate panel turns the film from being a downer to being one which ends in optimism, because people say, well, we didn't see our own area. Can you, Mr. Panelist, Mrs. Panelist, can you tell me, you know, where are the koalas in the Sutherland Royal National Park? And we had, you know, someone right there who could say, well, they're in the Heathcote section and there's a colony of about 80 and they're doing okay, but some of them are getting smashed on the road. We need you to campaign for a road crossing. So it's like taking it right down from the macro to the micro level really quickly to say, well, in this area, you need an advocate in your council who actually is going to enforce the regulations, or you need someone in government, you know, who actually understands that the failure of the nature laws. So hopefully the film will go on, and it'll go on having these sort of conversations. And, you know, it's a shame that the mainstream broadcasters haven't picked it up yet, but I imagine they will eventually. They'll be worn down by us, by the screenings. So the screenings just keep coming, you know, we just get more bookings all the time. So.
And I guess for people who are interested in seeking out the film, how is the best way of finding out where they can do it, or if they can book a screening of their own?
Well, we have a website which is thekoalasfilm.com. And that's run by the filmmakers. They can contact our distributor, Dov, at Screen Inc. But they can get in touch with us at Film Projects, and that's info@filmprojects.com.au. So we can arrange for communities to show the film. We'll have a schools version soon when we do a cut down and a teacher's kit. We really hope it'll keep going out to schools and communities, and people can, you know, book a hall or a cinema and put it on. But as long as the cinemas keep booking it, we'll keep showing it in cinemas. And we really hope it'll make an impact at some major, you know, festivals. We've got these festivals in Berlin and Amsterdam, Berlin and Copenhagen, called Down Under Film Festival, which is about profiling Australian films. So we're very hopeful that that'll start some conversations abroad about where the film can go. And we've got WWF as a sponsor, and they're interested to show it to their executives internationally. You know, I expect that the film will be used as an advocacy tool behind the scenes as well as in the public arena. So, I'll probably write a couple of papers on it or something myself about the learnings, because it's quite interesting talking to scientists and, you know, meeting people who are looking at animal-human relations and in relation to the Anthropocene and how we have to change our ways of doing things. There's just so many conversations that come out of the screenings that it's quite exciting.
Hey, thank you so much for listening to this interview with Georgia, talking about her documentary, The Koalas. To find out more about her film, head over to thekoalasfilm.com, where you can also book a screening for your local area. I really appreciate you listening and supporting the show. If you want to listen to more interviews or read reviews or anything else, head over to thecurb.com.au. Thanks again, and I will see you on the next episode.